Good morning and welcome to today's All Sides Weekend. It's the Book Show. I am Christopher Purdy. I'm delighted to welcome our panel to talk about everybody's favorite reads, some books you may not yet have heard of, some books you may have heard a lot about that you're going to hear a lot more about with different perspectives from our guests today. Cassie Rose, of course, is WOSU's book critic. Her blog is thelongestchapter.com. It is indispensable for anyone who loves to read. Mark Maxwell is here. He is the regional manager for Half Price Books. And I am delighted to welcome Chris Hickey. Now, Chris has been with us before, but I think this is her debut as our permanent panelist. Chris Hickey is going to be with us every show from the Columbus Library with the library's Quick Picks and more. Chris Hickey is Youth Services Manager at the Whetstone Library. May I just say, how cool is the Whetstone Library?
I agree. I think it is cool as well.
We're delighted you're with us, and thank you for coming today. And I asked you to start to I wanted to open with you because it's your debut, so it's time for you to give us a book recommendation as we begin the show today.
So the first book that I'm going to share today, it is not one of our quick picks, but it could be. This is a fun, sweet, delightful book.
Thank God.
There's nothing heavy in this book. It is called Waiting for Tom Hanks by Carrie Winfrey. Carrie Winfrey is a Columbus resident. She was born in Bellevue, Ohio. And her character is her character, Annie, lives in German Village. And you will see a lot of German Village when you read this book. There's the book loft. There's Katzinger's. She talks about Schiller Park. And her uncle works at the guard tower. So there's a lot of things that will be recognizable in this book. So Annie is obsessed with rom-coms, and she's obsessed with characters, not Tom Hanks per se, but his characters. So rom-coms, romantic comedies. So, you've got Mail, Sleepless in Seattle. So, she'll want to know if potential boyfriends have a houseboat like the character did in Sleepless in Seattle. So the story starts where a romantic comedy is being filmed in German Village, and the director happens to be the former roommate of her uncle. They roomed together at The Ohio State University, and he gets her a job as his personal assistant. So there's this famous actor who everyone is in love with. His name is Drew Danforth. And as reading this book, I pictured Ryan Reynolds. Because he just kind of, he's goofy, he's handsome, and she thinks he's a jerk. So, awkward bumping into, those weird moments that you see in romantic comedies. And then they eventually start to think of each other in that way, and all these odd things happen, and she's super awkward. So, it's highly improbable, but does it matter? It's sweet and it feels good, and it's set here.
And it's set here. Again, the name of the writer. Tell me about the writer.
So this is her first one. She's going to make this into a series. So a lot of it takes place in a coffee shop. That does not exist, but it's a coffee shop. And so her second book is going to be going into the lives of some of the coffee shop people.
And her name is Carrie
Winfrey. Her name is Carrie Winfrey.
Probably no relation.
I don't believe she is related to Oprah Winfrey.
Well, good for her anyway. And the book is called?
The book is called Waiting for Tom Hanks.
And probably Tom Hanks wrote the introduction.
That would be something.
Or there'll be t-shirts. But that's just a good, fun read set here in Central Ohio.
It's just a feel-good movie set in a neighborhood we know.
And I suspect if it's not yet a quick pick, it will be one soon. Just tell us very quickly, review what the quick picks are.
So quick picks, the concept of quick picks are these are the books that have long waiting lists. So we want you to be able to walk into one of our buildings knowing that you already have it on reserve. But, oh, surprise, there's the copy of the book that I've been waiting for.
And I think they go out for a month and they don't renew. Is that right?
They go out for 21 days. They do not renew. These are not reservable items. So they will be sitting there waiting for you. But they do not renew.
And I think, was it Tuesday mornings you reload?
Yes. Tuesday morning is the publishing day. So that's when we restock with brand new items. So if you like to come to the library in the morning, Tuesday is the day.
So be waiting at 8:30 with your coffee outside the
Correct.
Door of any branch.
Correct. And sometimes people do that.
I'm sure
yes.
they do. All right. Well, thank you very much, Chris Hickey from the Whetstone Library, talking about quick picks. You'll have a lot more to tell us in the course of today's program. Cassie Rose and Mark Maxwell had a fight off mic about books that should be winning the Nobel Prize, et cetera. And we're going to go from Sweet and Wonderful and German Village to Margaret Atwood. Mark Maxwell, what did you bring us?
Margaret Atwood can be sweet and wonderful.
Indeed.
I brought with me what is certainly the most popular book at Half Price Books right now. It is probably the biggest book in the country right now. It is The Testaments by Margaret Atwood. So Margaret Atwood is one of the best known writers in the world. It is an event in the publishing industry anytime she publishes a novel. But this one is particularly significant because it is a sequel to The Handmaid's Tale, which is certainly her best known book. So The Handmaid's Tale, for anyone who hasn't read it, is a dystopian novel set in a near future America called the Republic of Gilead, in which men who call themselves commanders exercise total control over women. It's a very dark and forbidding book, and it's been a bestseller for 35 years.
I was going to say The Handmaid's Tale came out in the mid-80s, I believe.
That's correct.
It was a sensation then, and
huge.
I wonder if she was predicting the future, or I mean, I was very much around 30 years
right.
ago, but I'm trying to remember 30 years ago in detail, and I can't. But
like all dystopian novels, The Handmaid's Tale was a warning. And Margaret, it's not a spoiler to say that in the afterword to this book, Margaret Atwood makes clear that she thinks that it's a warning that wasn't heeded. And so she's given us this new book. And I have to say, The Handmaid's Tale is a book that means a lot to me. When I heard that Atwood was about to publish a sequel, my first thought was that that sounded like kind of a dubious enterprise. It's not unusual for a writer to go back and revisit characters from their previous books. But writing a sequel to something that has become a modern day classic, there are so many ways that could go wrong. Fortunately, though, Margaret Atwood is a first-rate writer. She's at the top of her game, and she's given us a wonderful book here, a book that's very different from The Handmaid's Tale. So The Handmaid's Tale is told from the point of view of a narrator who spends most of the novel sitting in a room, kind of desperately trying to figure out what's going on. This book, though, pulls back the camera a little bit, and we get a lot more context. So now we have three narrators. Two of them are young women. One is being raised in the Republic of Gilead and being sort of groomed to be someone's wife. One is being raised in Canada by a couple of hippies running a thrift store. So for the first time, we get to see what the Republic of Gilead looks like from outside of the Republic of Gilead. And that is fascinating. But what is most interesting is that the third narrator is Aunt Lydia, who in The Handmaid's Tale is one of the villains of the book. So the aunts in the world of A Handmaid's Tale are a sort of mysterious group of women.
Yeah, the wardens.
Right. Yeah. They're responsible for indoctrinating young women and sort of preparing them for the roles that they'll play. And Aunt Lydia is the head of that order. So for the first time, we get to see what Aunt Lydia's life was like, how she becomes the person that she becomes, and what she really thinks about the Republic of Gilead. So one of the first things that we find out about Aunt Lydia in the book is that she has a secret shelf where she keeps novels by Jane Austen and stories by Alice Munro. And what we find is that Aunt Lydia is a more conflicted character than we imagine. She doesn't become entirely sympathetic. So to the very end, even when she's doing things that we would want her to be doing, she still does them by cold manipulation and seems to enjoy it. But this book, I think, is a worthy successor. Time will tell whether it's an effective counterbalance. But what's best about it and what I took from it, and I understand that Chris just finished it as well, is that this is a book about hope. And that makes it kind of a counterbalance to The Handmaid's Tale.
It's called The Testaments by Margaret Atwood. It probably is the most discussed book in America right now, I would think.
Certainly.
And I'm sure it's probably a quick pick at the Columbus Library as well.
Pick.
And I'm sure there's probably a 2-year waiting list to read it. But get on the list or walk in on Tuesday morning and see if it's there. Cassie Rose, our book critic, thelongestchapter.com. We have Margaret Atwood and we have Tom Hanks. What do you got for us?
Well, I'm debating whether or not I should just go down the path and talk about Ben Lerner's book, The Topeka School, which is a great novel that has come out, very intoxicating. But I'm pulled toward what has just been talked about with Margaret Atwood, which I think is great. I have not read the book. I've not read The Handmaid's Tale either. It came out in 85. I was in a place in my life where I didn't want to read what I thought was science fiction, didn't understand, I think, dystopian. So I didn't read it. And I understand that to really get the Testaments, I have to read The Handmaid's Tale, as everyone's. But I've read a lot about it. I'm wondering if she felt she needed to write it because the Hulu series was moving forward beyond The Handmaid's Tale without her control.
Possibly. I mean, she sets the novel about 15 years after The Handmaid's Tale. And what that means is that she kind of leapfrogs what's happening in the show. And she does incorporate a couple of plot points from the television show, but she ignores or even blatantly contradicts some other plot points. Mm-hmm. So it's not directly related to the television show.
So then the other thing that I've been thinking about with Margaret Atwood, I've been following the Man Booker Prize.
Right.
And so they're now down to their short list. And Margaret Atwood's book is listed. So is this, the one American book, is this one called Ducks Newburyport by Lucy Ellman. If you haven't heard about it, it's quite a publishing phenomenon because it is 1,020 pages and it's one sentence. It is, I have not read it because I'm 50 pages away from finishing War and Peace, and I'm not really ready to jump into another
Cassie, huge book.
So, but this one, Ducks Newburyport, the publisher sent it to me. I've read parts of it. The way that the author works the one sentence is she connects it with the fact that. So it would be the fact that I went to the store, the fact that I started the car, the fact that I brought the kids home. And it is in the mindset of an Ohio woman who is baking pies in her home to earn money, and it is her inner thoughts. And they go from everywhere from domestic issues to personal issues to about her husband, her kids, to her friends, to political issues, to why the wall is being built or why is someone doing this or that in the world. It's kind of like we think now, the way that our thoughts and our energies are pulled. I have listened to a lot of podcasts about this. The people who've read it say it is propulsive, so you can't keep going and keep going. Not repulsive, Mark, propulsive.
But can your mind get lost if you're reading something with no punctuation?
I think what you do is you get lost in her thinking and you can follow it, and that some of her thoughts are brilliant, but you just keep going. It's like potato chips, just one after the other after the other. And
is the writing that – you said potato chips. No, you can't put them down. Is the writing that compelling?
No, it's the thoughts, okay. I believe. And I think that from what – again, I've not read it, but from what I have heard about it, I was listening to a podcast and they were saying that she does give you relief that in the way that she writes with the fact that. But also there's a small story in here, too, about a mountain lion and the cubs, which is supposed to be some subset of a story. But I think that it's – you want to read it because you get caught up in her thoughts and in her thinking. Now, I do question, you know, the main question is, does it take 1,020 pages to tell this story?
We don't know yet.
We don't know. And I haven't really heard anyone weigh in on that. I mean, could she have done this in 400 pages? I don't know. But
Cassie,
anyway,
nobody's finished it yet, probably.
You're right. They're,
I mean, they will. I mean, next program, we'll probably have some answers to that.
Well, and here's another thing about the Man Booker Prize. So when the books are nominated, the judges read the books. They come up with a long list. Then to get to the short list, they read all those long list books again. So they've read the book twice. Now it's at the short list. So now they have to read it again to come with the winner. By the time that they announce the winner, they will have read Margaret Atwood's book, The Testaments, and this book, Ducks Newburyport, and this book I also have here, 10 minutes, 38 seconds in this strange world, three times, plus three other books, three times. Can you imagine reading 1,020 pages three times?
They lie.
I
read that.
You're right.
We have to take a break. We'll be back in just a moment with more from our guests, Chris Hickey from the Whetstone Library, Cassie Rose, WOSU's book critic, Mark Maxwell from Half Price Books, and we'll have an interview with Sister Helen Prejean. Don't go away.
How do you turn what you love into a career? On season 2 of the Rivet podcast from WOSU, hear firsthand from students translating their interests into jobs without college. Listen to This American Graduate Project as we highlight the next generation of workers in the state's top industries of agriculture, insurance, and healthcare. Support for the Rivet podcast series comes from COSI. Subscribe now at wosu.org/rivet, on the WOSU mobile app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you.
We are back with today's edition of Half Price Books. And there he is, Mark Maxwell, right there of All Sides Weekend. Same rhythm. That's why I see same rhythm.
Right.
All Sides Weekend Books. I'm Christopher Purdy with Mark Maxwell, who is the regional manager for Half Price Books. Chris Hickey is the youth services manager at Whetstone Library. She's here with the library's quick picks. And Cassie Rose is WOSU's book critic. Cassie was talking about Duck's Newburyport, which is the 1,000-page, one-sentence novel that's a finalist in the Man Booker Award. But you had another book that was also featured there. I just want you briefly to mention that one as well.
Sure. It's a finalist, 10 minutes, 38 seconds in this strange world by Elif Shafak, S-H-A-F-A-K. She is a Turkish author, very well known and well read in Turkey. And actually, she lives in London because the government in Turkey is investigating her because she writes about the treatment of women in the country and they don't like it. This book is the 10 minutes and 38 seconds. There is a woman who is murdered and we are in her last minutes of thinking. So every chapter is the 10 minutes or the 38 seconds as her brain is shutting down. That sounds kind of gruesome, but it's not. We learn about her life in Turkey. She grows up in a small town outside of Istanbul, and to escape the claustrophobic treatment of her family, she runs to Istanbul, where she becomes a prostitute on the street of brothels, which is a legal street. I'm taking it in Istanbul. And she makes a great cadre of friends, and they are of all different makes and models, you could say. And it's really about how she dies. What happens to her? How does she get murdered and thrown into a dumpster? So I was fascinated by the book because I don't know the culture in Turkey. And it very much took me into that, not just the treatment of women, but just what their society is. And she also very evocatively brings to life Istanbul. So that is what attracted me to the book. She does get a little preachy in it, and we're forcing some issues. But I think that the book is worth reading and very good. And obviously the judges for the Booker Prize feel that it's an award-worthy book. Is, again, this atmosphere that she creates and what we learn about women, and not just them, but also the men. I mean, she has a young boy who she grows up with, and he is very much in love with her and follows her, tries to find her, even though he does have to get into a traditional marriage. The characters are very likable, lovable. It is hard to see what happens to her at the end. But I can also say that she has a great group of friends, and you understand what that loyalty is and can feel that. I would be surprised if it won, again, with it being up against this Duck's Newburyport and also The Testaments. The other three books I have not read, but we'll see. The thing is about this author, she is very well known, and I think this is her 17th or 18th novel.
Give us her name again.
It's Elif Shafak, E-L-I-F. S-H-A-F-A-K, Elif Shafak.
And the title?
10 minutes, 38 seconds in this strange world.
That's a recommendation from Cassie Rose, WOSU's book critic. And Mark Maxwell, I think, has brought a graphic novel somewhere. Oh, he's brought, no, he doesn't. We'll get back because I want to talk about that in a moment. But Chris Hickey from the Whetstone Library has brought us one of her quick picks that's also going to be controversial or revealing in some ways. Let me give it to you, Chris Hickey.
Sure. This is Unfollow, a memoir of living and leaving the Westboro Baptist Church by Megan Phelps Roper. So Megan Phelps Roper, she is the granddaughter of Fred Phelps, who is the creator of this church. So we're expecting this is going to be the next hillbilly elegy educated
if
read.
You don't remember what the Westboro Baptist Church was.
So this is the controversial church that burns Qurans. They're also very well known for picketing military funerals.
They're very anti-gay.
They're very anti-gay. Right. They're anti a lot of things.
Right.
But so she tells the story. She did leave the church because she learned more about the world on Twitter. So she started out as a 5-year-old girl holding a sign that she was not able to read. And that sign said, "Gays are worthy of death." And so as a child, she was raised on the picket line with her family members. Not understanding what she was doing. And then became their social media person. So she engaged with people on Twitter constantly. And what she found is people surprisingly were very kind to her and really pushed her And she was able to learn more about the world. And the people that she would engage with on Twitter would find her on the picket line as they would go about the country. And she shares a story of a friend named David who runs a blog called Jewlicious. And so he came to visit her on the picket line. He brought her some Israeli treats. And with one hand, she handed him kosher chocolates that she had brought for him. And in the other hand, she's holding a sign that says, God hates Jews. So it's just very, very strange. And this same person, when she did leave the church, helped her find sanctuary in the home of a rabbi that she had also protested and held horrible signs about him.
I'm assuming her family has repudiated her completely and turned their backs on her.
I think her sister did leave with her.
Okay.
And her mother may have as well.
Okay, good.
She kind of mentioned that a little bit in her TED Talk. But it's going to be a fascinating behind the veil of this controversial. But she talks about how her belief came from a good place, which I think is interesting because she honestly didn't know any better. She
was 5 years old.
Yeah, she was 5 years old. And, you know, they honestly believed that they were the good in the world and that everyone else was unclean and evil. And so having that belief system, she didn't know anything else.
And that what a story to get older, to you know, to become, go to, you know, get grade school age and realize that what you've been fed is not the way it is.
Right. And yeah. I think it was way beyond that. I think it was when she was an adult that she finally started to realize maybe there's something wrong with what we're doing.
That is one of the quick picks from the Columbus Library. It's called Unfollow. Fred Phelps is no longer with us. This is his granddaughter.
This is his granddaughter.
Okay. We look forward to hearing more about that. And Mark Maxwell, you brought us Harry Potter.
I did.
Tell me about... Are you just reading Harry Potter
for
the
first time?
Yeah, I
thought I'd introduce everyone to an obscure young adult series. Scholastic has been publishing at long intervals beautiful, giant, illustrated versions of the Harry Potter books. It's taking a couple of years to produce them. They're illustrated by Jim Kay, who's just a wonderful, wonderful illustrator. They just released Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, which is the fourth book. I thought I brought it because I know a lot of Potterheads who have been just anxiously awaiting this thing. It's taken him 2 years to produce it. The books get bigger as you go along, so it's taking him a longer time to make them.
They did initially, too, really.
They did indeed. And I think, and this may be a controversial statement, but I think Goblet of Fire is the best Harry Potter book. It's kind of right on the bubble between the sort of younger ones and the older ones, and it's before everything starts to get dark. So I know a lot of people are super excited to see it.
Well, my daughter was a little girl when they came out, and she was devouring them. She's always been a great reader, but she you know, the book was bigger than she was for a while. Then she
right,
was, and so I read them too, and I'm a Potterhead. I fell in love with them as well. So I'm delighted to know you've got these big books, richly illustrated, but it's still all the text, right?
All the text and just wonderful illustrations. And yeah, this thing weighs about 100 pounds. I used to joke in the old days as the books were getting larger that the last one would be called Harry Potter and the Chiropractor's Retirement.
Well, I mean, people are at my age, at least, will have trouble schlepping them around. But I'm glad I read them initially, and I'm glad to know that those are out there. What's the spoke you have on the top? That one right there.
I brought a book that was long listed, but not short listed for the Man Booker Prize.
Let's define the Man Booker Prize for people like me who don't know what you're talking about.
The Man Booker Prize is one of the most prestigious literary awards in the world. It's a British literary award, but it is open to as of fairly recently, it is open to anyone who writes in English, not just members of the United Kingdom or former colonies.
But it has to be published in the UK.
Right. It has to be published in the UK.
Right. Yeah. So that includes American books, essentially.
Yeah. Well, American books really have only been, I think Americans have only been considered for the last several prizes.
Yeah.
Right.
So like a UK publisher has to pick up the American book and release it in the UK.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
What's the book?
The book is called My Sister, the Serial Killer by Oyinkan Braithwaite, which is a great title, and it's very descriptive of what happens. So it's the story of two sisters, Korede and Ayula, who live in Lagos, Nigeria, which is where the author lives.
The older sister, Karede, she's a nurse. She works in a small hospital. She's a kind of a neat freak. But the younger sister is more attractive, more charismatic, certainly sloppier. And the younger sister has an unsettling habit of killing her boyfriends, which at first
all
seems...
Many
of them. Yeah. So at first it seems like sort of an unfortunate series of accidents. But the book opens with the older sister being summoned to the scene of a murder where she's cleaning up after the third boyfriend that her sister has murdered. And as she points out, after three, they consider you to be a serial killer. So the sister is kind of involved in covering up these crimes. And what happens is the older sister has a crush on a handsome young doctor who works in the hospital, who meets the younger sister and falls in love with her. So there's an enormous amount of tension in this book. It is surprisingly lighthearted for the subject matter. And it's just a wonderful kind of extreme story of sibling rivalry.
The title again and the author.
My Sister, the Serial Killer by Oyinkim Braithwaite.
And this did get a great deal of attention. And the New York Times Book Review went to town with it and thought it
Indeed.
Was great. So it got a lot of attention. And that is something that was long-listed for the Man Booker Prize.
Yes.
And we'll discuss later why it wasn't short-listed. Maybe somebody can send an email. You're listening to All Sides Weekend Books today. I'm Christopher Purdy with Mark Maxwell from Half Price Books, Chris Hickey from the Whetstone Library, and WOSU's book critic Cassie Rose. We're going to take a little digression for a moment. Sister Helen Prejean is the author of Dead Man Walking, which was her journey counseling inmates on death row, which was made into a movie starring Susan Sarandon, for which Susan Sarandon won the Oscar. It became an opera by Jake Hedgie, which is performed everywhere. Sister Helen has a new book out, a new memoir called River of Fire, My Spiritual Journey, and she will be in Columbus tonight at 7 at St. John's Church on Mound Street to talk about the book and her spiritual journey. And yesterday, she and I spent some time together on the phone. Here's part of my conversation with Sister Helen Prejean. Now, in your book, you were very young when you entered religious life. What kind of life did you expect to have then? What attracted you to the order?
Well, it was a very pious, prayerful life, and I expected that I would just simply be obeying superiors as the voice of God in my life. Back then in 1957, I was just 18. We had great nuns who taught us. I wanted to be a teacher, but you had the novitiate training, which was really removed from everything. You didn't have a newspaper. You didn't even look at TV. So the whole idea was to be prayerful, get to know Christ, to live Christ in your life, but very removed from the world and its suffering. So the whole book, River of Fire, was about waking up that the gospel of Jesus was, as Pope Francis likes to say, is being the field hospital out there on the margins where the people are wounded and hurting. And the whole book of River of Fire is about that waking up, that being Christian, following the way of Jesus, is about being a person of justice and not just simply being charitable to people around me, most of whom were privileged people like me out in the suburbs.
Were you prepared then for the life you have now?
Well, prepared, I don't know how to deal with that word prepared. It's that, well, I know that the spiritual grounding of learning how to find a deep center, which came from trying to really develop spirituality, is under me. And that helped because I never dreamed that I'd be witnessing and accompanying people to three people to electrocution, three people to lethal injection, nor that I would be encountering the terrific, unbelievable suffering of victims' families who wake up in the morning and it's a normal day. And before the moon has come out, even, they have been plunged into grave because the loved one has been brutally murdered. I just had never reached or met the depths of grief or suffering that was going on in the world, and I plunged into all of that. And prepared, I don't know that I was ever prepared. It's like a wave that keeps rolling in front of you, and you kind of ride it. But all I know is that looking back on it, the grace was inside me as it happened. And it's It's been a very life-giving, energizing thing for me. I'm still full of energy in this work, part of which is the American people, that I was not disappointed when I wrote the book, Dead Man Walking, when I started going out talking to people and bringing them close to the reality of what the death penalty is. They responded, and we can see that happening. That's why I want to be in Ohio, because Ohio should be executing people. And I mean, Ohio is one of the last states that's just been doing really terrible things, and it's time for Ohio to change. And being there with Journey of Hope, which is, you know, I'm with them. They're the victim's family, Bill Pelkey, and these people who have lost loved ones and who have stood up steadfastly and just said, violence is not the answer to our pain. Watching the state kill the one who killed my loved one, watching that violence is not going to heal me. And their voices have really been strong, and I think they've been a big contributing factor to the United States. Most states now beginning to put the death penalty down, and I hope Ohio. Well, just look at the track record and look at what's happening in the United States. Amnesty International says in order to see what's happening in the country, you always look and see what's happening in practice before you look and see finally the legalized repeal that'll happen in legislatures. In practice, we are shutting down the death penalty. Did you realize or did you know that 2% of counties, prosecutors in 2% of counties are responsible for 50% of the death penalties in this country? Very few prosecutors are still going for the death penalty. Even in Texas, that used to get 48 death sentences a year, in the last 2 years, they have been zero. Juries aren't giving out death sentences because now they can be told, here's the alternative. You don't have to choose death. Prosecutors are being confronted with, it's your decision whether to go for death or not. You don't have to go for the death penalty. And we can see the results happening in this country. When Dead Man Walking came out in 1993, 80% of the American public, if they were asked the question, said they supported the death penalty. Now it's close to 50%, and when in the question they are given the alternative of life imprisonment instead of death, it falls below 50%. So there's still these pockets where it's happening, and that's where the energy needs to go. That's why Ohio is one of the places.
We never thought the sisters, and in my day they wore the full habits, had any kind of human life. And your book, you had very close friendships. You had a lot of personal struggles that you're very candid about in this book.
Yeah, it's part of being human. And first of all, part of being human is not to live without any close relationships, just trying to love everybody. What kind of life is that? And so, I mean, to develop friendship and intimacy. And so I talk about my close friend, Chris, and we stayed friends until she died, close friends. And then with a priest who had a lot of struggles, I didn't realize in the beginning that he was an alcoholic and all. And it was a very loving relationship, but he needed me to be happy in a way I knew I couldn't fulfill and find it. So I just take people through that because we all, when we enter into close relationships, it's not just this little even-keel thing of I love you, you love me, and isn't life wonderful? You go through all kinds of stuff together, and I wanted to be candid about that.
Sister Helen Prejean, the author of Dead Man Walking, her new book is River of Fire, My Spiritual Journey. She is going to be speaking tonight at 7 o'clock at St. John's Church on Mound Street downtown. That was part of my conversation with Sister yesterday. I'm Christopher Purdy. This is All Sides Weekend Book. We're going to take a quick break and be right back. Don't go away. We are back on All Sides Weekend Books. I'm Christopher Purdy. This is The Book Show with Mark Maxwell, Regional Manager of Half Price Books. Chris Hickey is Youth Services Manager at the Whetstone Library. She will be with us regularly, offering us the library's quick picks. And Cassie Rose is WOSU's book critic. Her blog, not to be missed, is thelongestchapter.com. I wanted to ask Chris Hickey again to offer us another quick pick from the library. Get there fast.
Okay. So Over the Top, Jonathan Van Ness, who is one of the beloved characters of Queer Eye on Netflix. This is his memoir. It's called Over the Top, A Raw Journey to Self-Love. People often ask him, why are you so over the top? He's the grooming and self-care expert on the show. And so he's going to explain that in his memoir. And he has a lot to tell. So his life experiences are very interesting. He is HIV positive, and he actually speaks about that at length in his book. I've seen interviews. He just really wants people to be aware of where people who are HIV positive are in the world right now, and you know what healthcare is doing for them.
They're living. Thank God.
Yes,
yeah, they're living.
It's
yes.
Not the death sentence.
Yeah.
So his story is just fascinating, and I haven't read it yet, but I'm waiting for it to come out on audio because I think it will be very enjoyable on audio. He reads it himself.
If we don't know the TV show, could you just give us a little precis of what that is?
So this is the reboot of a very popular show in the early 2000s called Queer Eye for the Straight Guy. It was on Bravo, and so this is the reboot that is wildly popular on the Netflix show. So basically, five gay men have different areas of expertise, and they make over a person. Now, it's not just straight men like it was in the previous series. It's all kinds of people. It's women. It's transgendered people. So it is probably one of the most uplifting shows on television. A lot of people cry during them. It's beautiful. It's a show full of kindness. And basically, they're celebrating this person that they're trying to help. Karamo Brown is trying to help them with their emotional self-care. Jonathan is helping them with their physical. Bobby Burke fixes up their homes. Anthony Porosky teaches them in
number?
The kitchen.
Okay.
I know.
Yeah, really?
They are. They are terrific. And then Tan France, who also has a quick pick.
He has a book out. Yeah,
and he actually helps them with their clothing. So the Jonathan, this is his story. So we have a memoir from Tan France, Karamo Brown, Jonathan Van Ness. And then I also just wanted to mention Anthony has a cookbook called Anthony in the Kitchen. So this is relatively new as well. It's not a quick pick, but we do have these in the library. There's a foreword written by Ted Allen, who was the food and wine expert on the original series. And Anthony does share a little bit about his story. He does have several pages of a short memoir at the beginning, but it's mostly recipes.
Have you tried any?
I haven't tried any yet. I just checked it out.
Next time you come back.
I'm definitely going to try.
Report in.
But these are fantastic books, and for the fans of the show and beyond.
Over the Top is the one that you're talking about now.
Correct.
And
Over the Top is Jonathan Van Ness.
A quick pick from the Columbus Library. Come in on a Tuesday morning and you might find it there, but you can always reserve online.
Yes, you can.
For anything you want at the Columbus Library. Cassie Rose, what is the Topeka School?
The Topeka School is a novel by Ben Lerner. It just came out last week. Ben Lerner is a literary darling among critics. This is his third novel. He is also a MacArthur Genius Grant, whatever that is anyway.
He got a lot of money for being smart.
Yeah,
okay,
there we go.
It.
Yeah, all absolutely. Right. This school is obviously at this school. This book is set in Topeka, obviously. It focuses on a family. There's nothing really big that I can hang this on, but this is an extraordinary book and it's intoxicating. And it's not that I couldn't put it down. It's that I didn't want to put it down.
Oh, good.
It focuses on a family of Jonathan and Jane, who are psychologists, transplants from the East Coast. And they are teaching and giving therapy at an institute in Topeka, raising their son, Adam. He's in high school. It's 1996. Adam is on the debate team. The book opens with Adam in a rowboat on a man-made lake surrounded by McMansions, and he loses his girlfriend, or he just looks around and she's not there, and he doesn't see her in the water.
She didn't fall off the boat. She's just not there.
She's not there. So he looks around. He goes back to shore. He decides he'll go back to the house. He walks in the house. He walks upstairs to her room. He sees she's in bed. He goes into the bathroom. Then he realizes it's not her bathroom, and he's in the wrong house because all the houses look alike. So he goes and finds her at the house, and she does. She comes to the front door. And then he goes home, and he sleeps for 4 hours and goes to a debate in Russell, Kansas. And at the end of the debate, when the medal is being given, there's a big flurry at the door, and Senator Bob Dole walks in. And this is about,
why wouldn't he? Sure.
This is about a month or 2 months away from the election where he's running against the incumbent Bill Clinton. And Ben Lerner writes a line in here, and this is from the viewpoint of Adam of It's the End of History. Well, what he is implying here is that it is the beginning. It is the end of history for the red state, for the conservatives, for we are now entering into the era of liberal urbanites. It's very subtle, and I can't emphasize that enough, because this really is the focus on the family. We also go into the viewpoint of Jane, who is his mother, who has written a best-selling book. She's been on Oprah. It's about relationships. She's a feminist, and she gets phone calls in the middle of the night from men who are saying ugly four-letter words and making comments to her in the grocery. The way that Ben Lerner handles this is, again, I did not want it to end. You love the characters. You love this family. You do not feel any real anger for anyone that is working against them. He is showcasing a time. And there is also a message there about, well, I'll just say that the father remembers when he was brought up in Taipei, 2 years, son of a diplomat, in about the 1950s, and about Imperial America, and about how they had all the Chinese taking care of them. He is not preachy at all, which is what I was concerned about with Elif Shafak's book. It is so well done. And again, you love the characters, and you see normal America going on here, and you love these characters. There is also a boy who is not in the senior class, but the senior class sort of surrounds him. He's challenged, mentally challenged, and there is an incident that happens that does provide tension in the book, and Ben Lerner, again, trails it through the book in a way that, again, makes this book, for me, as I said, I didn't want to stop reading.
So it's a positive read.
It's not a positive, and it's not a negative read. That's where Ben Lerner is brilliant. It's a good read, and you come away feeling like I've been somewhere, I've experienced something, I get what's going on here, I get why all the characters on all the sides are feeling and speaking and acting the way that they are. I don't feel the author is pushing something at me, but he is brilliantly telling me something. And I think part of what he's telling is that if you look at what he's writing about in 1990 and about the high school boys and their mentality and what's going on, and the men today in Kansas that are 36, would be 36 years old or so, that there is a reason for that. I think that that's some of what's going on here.
It's called The Topeka School by Ben Lerner, recommended by Cassie Rose. And I've often said, and I'm going to say it again, if Cassie tells you to read a book, read the book.
Thank you.
She's always right. Speaking of which, you didn't recommend this, but I think everybody else did. And my wife could not put down Stephen King's The Institute, which is, I think, the number one fiction bestseller right now. Couldn't put it down. Got it from somebody else who couldn't put it down. I'm having a little trouble because what they do to these children is so horrendous that it's, and I like Stephen King. He and Grisham, I think, are great storytellers, and I really admire them both. But I'm finding it rough going. The writing is very compelling, but what happens is really you want to kill people when you're reading this book. I don't know if any of you've read it, but it's very. I recommend it, but it is a real page turner. But I've had to put it down a little bit once in a while and pick up Dr. Zhivago or something else. I don't know. But that's Stephen King's The Institute. Now, Jojo Moyes is a name I've seen a lot. Mm-hmm. I don't know much about Jojo Moyes, but you, Chris Hickey, have a recommendation of a book by Jojo Moyes for
us. I do. So her new book is The Giver of Stars. So she is well known for Me Before You,
Life After You, you know, her books. She's British. This one is a historic fiction novel of hers. So she has a character, Alice Wright, who has come from England. She marries a handsome American named Bennett Van Cleve. She wants to escape dreary England, but finds that small town Kentucky is also dreary. And so to escape all of the dreariness, she takes a job with Eleanor Roosevelt's traveling library. And she joins other women on horseback, and they become the horseback librarians of Kentucky. So it's, yeah, it sounds really interesting. So this book has romance, there's domestic violence, learning to fight back, and her characters, she has characters with very strong personalities. So fans of hers, I think, will enjoy this. And, you know, the librarians bring controversy. There's one instance where there's
a
woman.
As you do.
Yes, we bring the controversy. So, you know, there's a woman having marital problems. So they bring her a book on intimacy, which, of course, causes all kinds of controversy. But, yeah, if someone's in the mood for some good historic fiction with great characters, JoJo Moyes is the giver of stars. She's the way to go.
And that's a quick pick from the
library.
That
is a quick from the library. She's very popular.
And Mark Maxwell, you have a book about the American Revolution, I know, because I've read it, because I'm from Lexington, Massachusetts, so I know I don't know all about it, but I grew up in Minuteman Lane, for God's sake. But give me some fiction or talk about whatever you want, Mark Maxwell. You're smarter than I am anyway.
I brought a nonfiction book that I really love lately. Okay. It's called Go Ahead in the Rain, Notes to a Tribe Called Quest. It's by a local author, which is something I didn't know until I actually picked it up. I picked it up because I love a Tribe Called Quest, which is a hip-hop group that did most of their work in the early 90s. The amazing thing about being a hip-hop fan and a book fan right now is that hip-hop has been around long enough so that there is a generation of people who have grown up in a world that living and breathing hip hop, thinking about it, and some of them have become marvelous writers. So we're starting to see some great literature about hip hop, and this book is a wonderful example. It's a personal memoir. It talks about the history of hip hop, and it's a wonderful elegy to a group that had an impact on a lot of people. Hanif Abdurraqib is the author. The title is "Go Ahead in the Rain: Notes to a Tribe Called Quest."
Hanif has been a guest on the program.
Oh,
here.
I didn't know that.
He's terrific. He's also a poet and a music journalist. And from someone like me, who's this fat old white man who is clueless, I mean, I read his stuff and I learn a great deal. I think he's terrific. So I'm delighted to have that recommendation of his book. I mean, he does live here. I don't think he's home much anymore because he's very hot right now.
I'm sure. Touring
everywhere and he's appearing everywhere. But give us the title again.
It's called "Go Ahead in the Rain: Notes to a Tribe Called Quest."
And he's a terrific local asset, although he has a global reach, Hanif does. And I'm delighted to have that recommendation. Okay, give me the battle over here.
Okay, so Rick Atkinson is, for my money, the best historian working in America right now. His Liberation Trilogy, which is the story of the American Army in Europe in World War II, is one of my favorite series of books of all time. He's just started a series about the American Revolution. The first volume of it came out earlier this year. It's called "The British Are Coming." Rick Atkinson does what some people have called literary pointillism, in which he has an amazing knack for finding colorful, wonderful details and using them to build the story. His work is really readable. It's not dry.
You can smell it. Seriously, you can. You can smell it.
He's a wonderful prose writer, and these books are worth going back to. They tend to be sort of dense with detail, and I'm happy to see him tackling another subject that's so complex as the American Revolution.
There's a wonderful scene at the beginning of the book where King George goes to christen a ship, you know, and just the way he gets into what the carriage was like and how he was dressed and how he was received, and then he lost his empire like 2 weeks
right.
later. Yes. Rick Atkinson, "The British Are Coming." That is a wonderful book, and I think there's going to be two more on the American Revolution. And I want to, in our last minutes, because it's her debut, I want Chris Hickey to sing us out with another recommendation, another quick pick from the Columbus Whetstone Library. Good throughout the library system.
Yes, you will find these at every branch.
Chris just happens to be at Whetstone, which is living in that neighborhood. That is the neighborhood place to be. That and the grocery store, the Whetstone Library, certainly. So Let me give it to you.
So I have a great fantasy read by Leigh Bardugo. She usually writes teen fiction, teen fantasy. And this one is called The Ninth House. And it is about secret societies at Yale. And what makes this even more interesting is that Leigh attended Yale and was part of a secret society. So the character is named Alex Stern, and she's a high school dropout. Involved in drug deal, you know, with drug dealers, you know, not having a very productive life. She becomes the sole survivor of a multiple homicide. And so someone, this mysterious person comes to her hospital and says, you'd be a good fit for Yale because you can see dead people.
All righty, we'll then. Give us the title and the author.
It's called The Ninth House by Leigh Bardugo.
And that is a quick pick from the Columbus
that
Library. Good at every branch. Cassie Rose, WOSU's book critic, thank you very much. Your blog is thelongestchapter.com. Chris Hickey, thank you for being here
with
the quick picks from the library. Mark Maxwell, regional manager for Half Price Books, thank you as well for all your recommendations. I'm Christopher Purdy. Thank you, Kyle McKinnon, our associate producer. Thank you, Mary Lee Williams, our producer. The All Size interns are Atia Touré, Tatiana Woodall, and Bobby Gerberic, with video production by Rich Blue and Amber Blue. I'm Christopher Purdy. Purdy out.